Have you ever listened to the pod and thought it would be awesome if Jen stopped being nerdy about movies for 60 seconds and talked about your business instead? Well, my friends, you're in luck. Watch with Jen is looking for sponsors. Do you own or run a theater, bookstore, film fest, website, school, physical media firm, pod, streaming channel, or small business that might like to advertise on Watch with Jen? Whether you're interested in sponsoring one episode or several, please reach out. You can get a hold of me at contact@filmintuition.com. Thanks so much. Hey, this is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen. This week on the podcast, I'm welcoming back Robert Bellissimo, who is an actor, acting teacher, and YouTube video podcaster. He's also an ongoing contributor to two Toronto film critics websites, In the Seats and Screenfish. Robert's channel on YouTube is an exploration of all things cinema, which includes reviews and in-depth interviews with guests who work in film. Robert, I want to thank you so much for being here. I always have just the best time talking movies with you, whether it's on your show or on mine. So thank you so much. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. It's great to be back. I always enjoy talking to you as well. And this is a heavy topic and a heavy three movies. Visconti, but he's one of my favorite filmmakers. So I'm really curious to hear your thoughts and talk more about this master filmmaker.
Yeah, I'm very excited. We talked about John Cassavetes last time, and I performed some excerpts as John Cassavetes. Probably a misguided idea. I'm not going to do that this time.
No, I loved it. I listened to it again recently, and I was like, I really like that you did that. Because I can listen to him all day, and I love that you included a lot of his quotes in there. So, yeah. Yeah, if you could speak Italian, you could do some Visconti.
I know. Yeah. I think the new goal is going to be asking my male friends when it comes to male voices to do that. Although I did do some Dennis Hopper last year, and that was a lot of fun. So there's something about these sort of alpha guys that makes it a little more entertaining, I think. But yeah, we need someone with an Italian accent or speaking Italian, I think, for this subject for sure. And but before we dive into that, what have you been working on lately?
Well, the show keeps me busy, as for anyone who has a podcast like yourself knows. It's a lot of work. So speaking of Italian film, I just released yesterday a review of Accattone, which was Pasolini's debut feature film. You know, him and Visconti have things in common. So, you know, perhaps that will come up. And as I mentioned to you before, we started recording. I started to dabble in writing a little bit. So here in Toronto, I've become friends with a couple of critics, and they both have websites where they have contributors post reviews. So I've managed to commit myself to doing one review a month for each of their sites. And so being Black History Month, I did an LA Rebellion film, Bless Their Little Hearts, that Charles Burnett wrote, and he was the DOP on. And which is a film I love, and Edge of the City with Sidney Poitier and co-starred Cassavetes, who of course you and I discussed. So I've been getting more interested in that area, and you know, going steady with the show and having a blast with it, you know.
Oh, that's so exciting. I'm excited to look up those reviews and read your work. Because you have so many original, great thoughts. You're very knowledgeable about film. So it makes sense that we should hire Robert to do some writing for us. All of these websites.
Yes, please.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. If you're listening, give him a call, basically, or appear on his show for sure. I think I have the best time. I know my friend Kate Gabrielle and another friend, Raquel Stutcher, have had greatest time. So
I love those two.
Yeah. So when it came to this, you are someone who knows your Italian cinema inside and out. I was really excited by this idea because I watched these movies probably like 25 or so years ago. I think, I don't know if it was like right at the beginning of film school when I was just kind of looking into movies or they were on TCM. But for whatever reason, you know, I haven't revisited them. I did see Senso, and I reviewed that, I think, when it came out from Criterion. They were kind enough to send. But I was really excited to get the opportunity to revisit all of these kind of back to back to back, which I think is really a cool way to see his autobiography and the way he kind of pursues similar themes and what he wants to do as a filmmaker, how he pushes those early boundaries from neorealism onward. So I would love to know, before we jump in, your relationship with Visconti's work and, you know, your favorites, any of your impressions overall. Yeah.
Well, I came to him gradually. He wasn't someone I took to immediately.
Yeah.
It was a more, you know, seeing something and then maybe perhaps not seeing something for a number of years. But initially, I think I said this when we talked about Cassavetes, like, I think if you're a Scorsese fan, he puts you on to so many, you know, different filmmakers. Exactly. And of course he got me interested in Cassavetes, and The Leopard is one of his favorite movies. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, well, I'll check out The Leopard. So that must have been, you know, 2006, 2007 or something. And I initially didn't care for it. I thought it was dull. I couldn't really get into it at the time. Even though, you know, there was a lot I could appreciate it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, I have the Blu-ray now here. And mm-hmm. I, you know, even back when I saw it, there has some great special features, interviews with, you know, Sidney Pollack and various people on it. So I didn't really take to it at first, but then other films, I came to him through getting interested in some of the people in his cast. You know, for example, Alain Delon, who's in Rocco and His Brothers. I didn't even know, this is an older DVD print before mm-hmm. the restoration that was produced that Gucci funded and the Film Foundation. So yeah. I didn't even know who Alain Delon was when I got this. I knew Visconti just from The Leopard, and I just was so taken by the title and by this picture, the mm-hmm. cover, and I just bought it. It was maybe in the late 2000s, and I sat on my shelf for a while, and then I was at my friend's house, and he had a book on Delon. I think it was a photography book, and I was so struck by his looks, not just because he's such a good looking guy, but just such an intense and interesting looking guy.
Yeah,
and there was a still from Rocco and His Brothers, and I put it together and I went home and watched it. And this one I did take to immediately because it's probably my favorite of his films because it explores Southern Italians moving to Milan. And myself, my family is from the south of Italy, and although they
so
didn't
are we.
Move to the, oh right
yeah.
And although we my family didn't move to the north of Italy, they moved to Canada, so many of the experiences in the film I really related to, and the characters, there was so much I just took to, and I've seen it a number of times, so that certainly was one I you know, loved immediately. And then, of course, I got interested in Dirk Bogarde, who was in, which I also have, Death in Venice.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also, this was one I did not like at first. I thought it was bland. I thought it was dull. I think I first saw it about 7 years ago. And I got interested in him, and he's also in The Damned, which I also... I also didn't take to at first because it is really provocative and dark, and it explores, you know, Nazis who are pedophiles and rapists, and it's and there's a scene of, you know, where he rapes his mother, Helmut Berscher character, and it's hard to watch. So, you know, and then of course I've seen almost all of his films, and some I took to more, like Senso, which you mentioned, I did really take to. But I've come and I started to think about this recently, and I was like, well, you know, his movies are often these long epics. There's a lot happening. They're very detailed. They're very emotional. They're very powerful. And it's funny because I often didn't take to his films for the most part on the first viewing, but I often did in the second viewing. Mm-hmm. And then I came to realize that I think the best way to watch a Visconti movie is to watch it twice back to back, which is a lot to ask. But they're really complicated and they're really challenging, and you have to fill in a lot of your own blanks. You know, he doesn't tell you everything. I mean, something like Death in Venice, oftentimes there isn't even a lot of dialogue. There's long stretches where it's silent, and so you have to watch it in a different way, and you have to be in the mood for it. I mean, even revisiting them again, even though I've seen, you know, all of these more than once, I still have a hard time, in a good way, a hard time, because you have to wrestle with them, and they really linger in your mind, I find, and they're ultimately very rich, very rewarding. And so, to me, if you've seen it once, any of them, you haven't seen them, you have to see them at least twice. That was how I came to get into him, gradually through a variation of actors and stuff. And then I think once my podcast hit off, my YouTube channel in 2020, as you said, the Italian reviews, I noticed they were doing well. And so naturally, I went towards Visconti films and seeing them again and reviewing them. And that's when I got really interested in him and his work. And his life is really fascinating. I mean,
my gosh,
he's an aristocrat, openly gay, and a communist. I mean, that's someone to look up.
Yes, the Italian resistance stuff is just fascinating in World War II. I watched a documentary that is available on YouTube. Actually, I watched it this morning. It's was made by the BBC, something like The Light and Times.
Yes, yeah,
it's a feature length. At first, it's just sort of meanders, but then it gets into his history. And I mean, you learn he was hiding like prisoners of war and fellow communists in plain sight, like as members of his household staff. And then I love that he was arrested because, like, as brilliant as he was and doing the right thing and for, you know, his reasons, he didn't think that the LV, he was using a nom de plume or he was using a different name on his shirt, is what, you know, identified him as Visconti. And so he was busted, unfortunately. But
yes,
then,
and sentenced to death, and he was able to get off the hook.
And then he was able to testify against that man who was later, you know, was sentenced to death himself. So it's a fascinating history for sure.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can't think of another filmmaker, even an artist, who, because he was an aristocrat, he's one of the richest men in the country from one of the most powerful families. Mm-hmm. He has that perspective, but then he moves to Paris in the 30s and works with Jean Renoir, when his left-wing politics form. And if you look at his movies, I mean, Rocco and His Brothers is this exploration of characters from the south of Italy who are poor. So he can go from that extreme on the political spectrum to the top, the princes and the people, the ruling crass, like in The Leopard.
Yeah.
And who else had or tried to do something like that? But he had this incredible insight, of course, into both worlds. And I think ultimately he shows how much human beings have in common, even though, you know, we're all have certain differences, you know, we have certain things in common. And he always takes things from a very humanist point of view. I mean, some people feel that, you know, The Leopard is like pro aristocrat. I mean, I don't see that. at all. I think he's just dealing with it as honestly as he can. And so he's an exciting filmmaker. And there actually, just in the last like 4 or 5 years, a number of books have come out on him, which unfortunately I haven't read any. I would really like to get into like a juicy book on him. Most of my knowledge is from like the documentary you saw and other documentaries and, you know, just reading stuff online or special features on Blu-rays and stuff. But a fascinating guy, which I'm sure we'll, you know, unpack much more as we go on.
Yeah, and I love that he comes right out of the neorealism school of filmmaking, because I think maybe the first two I do remember, because of Scorsese, of course, were Obsession and La Terra Trema, which I saw, those I think I saw in the 90s, the late 90s. Back then, I don't think it was on TCM, Bravo, way back before they became like the Real Housewives channel, used to run foreign films way, way back. They were kind of where you would get the Janus films and the Criterions. And I think I saw those on that channel, actually. And I remember finding it really cool that he was the one to adapt Postman Always Rings Twice 4 years before they did it in America, which is, you know, thrilling, I think, if you're a fan of crime fiction and noir filmmaking. And, you know, you see him kind of starting to come out of the neorealism with the first one we're going to talk about, Rocco and His Brothers. But I think, you know, he did embrace his upbringing and stuff, some of the opulence and the aristocratic, you know, you can't really shake that. He lives in castles.
Oh, of course, towns. Of course, yeah.
But I think that always stayed with him. And you do see his humanism and his warmth throughout. And I love what you were saying, too, about these movies being slow and ponderous and challenging. Because, Death in Venice is still quite, for all of the reasons you were bringing up, kind of a chore. It is, you know, just stunningly beautiful. They all are stunningly beautiful, but we'll get into that later. But these are movies that I think are going to be extremely hard for people who are used to like two screens or not really giving full attention to something or having a hard time, you know, with long takes and not a lot of, like, it's going to be, I think, a challenging watch for a lot of reasons, but a worthwhile one for sure. Or a challenging pair of watches, as you said, to watch them twice. So
yeah, definitely. Yeah. And you know, you mentioned Ossessione, which is not only the first neorealist film many consider, but I suppose you can also say it's the first Italian film noir, which is interesting. I was listening to Eddie Muller, the TCM host, because I think every other Thursday he does a live talk, and someone asked him about Italian film noir. And I think one of the first ones he said was Ossessione, as being like one of the great, you know, ones. So yeah, certainly someone worth exploring for anyone who loves movies.
Yeah. But talk to me about Rocco and His Brothers. You said you bought the DVD because of that striking cover. And I love what you were saying about Alain Delon, because of course he's known as one of the most beautiful, but similar experience. I had seen, I think, a couple movies with him, but didn't really put together who he was or anything when I watched. But he has those expressive eyes that, of course, would come out in Purple Noon and some of those films. But there they are right in this. This was kind of the movie that sort of launched him, a star-making turn for sure. But I would love to know more about Rocco and His Brothers.
Yeah, well, I mean, just a note on Delon. I think he worked with Visconti twice, so this and in The Leopard, and the performances he gave, particularly Rocco and His Brothers, he never did anything like that again. Oh. What I mean by that is he was a very subtle actor, you know, very, very. He's, you know, Steve McQueen and him had that in common. He could just do so much with the littlest looks and expressions. But in this film, which is so operatic and is so intense and melodramatic, you know, the actors, you can't just express something in a look or in a close up. It requires really deep, emotional, committed, rich, full acting. I mean, I haven't seen all of his movies, but the only other thing I can think of where he did something similar was Mr. Klein, the Joseph.
The Losi film.
The Losi, which is a very, very powerful film.
Yes.
But, this film to me, this is one of my, not just one of my favorite Visconti movies. It over the years has become one of my favorites. Because, you know, hopefully I won't get emotional talking about it, because it's so, I feel so deeply connected to this film. And when I reviewed it twice on my show. One thing I started to do was the episodes, videos that I noticed that were doing really well, I would re-review. I would go back with a different guest. And a couple of years ago, I did it again with a New York actor. Her name is Lucia Grillo, and she was actually in Summer of Sam, the Spike Lee film. Mm-hmm. And she had certain insights into it, which I hadn't really picked up on, because she said, oh, well, she said it's also a very political film. And I was like, well, because I never saw anything about it as being that political. But one thing that she points out, and perhaps this is just her own interpretation, but I think it's valid, is that these people who are from the south of Italy and are very innocent, and they're basically have lived a very pure life with each other, and that their means to get, you know, what their goal in life is mainly to survive, right? Mm-hmm. And they have one another. And as they moved over to Milan, and we see what happens to Simone, he begins mm-hmm. to steal. He obviously self-destructs and mm-hmm. commits murder, and he rapes this poor woman in front of his brother, and he gets into all this gambling mm-hmm. debt. All these gambling debts, and he destroys himself and a lot of things within the family. And ultimately, that, you know, you can look at it as that perhaps Visconti and his writers were saying that from going to a place of purity and then going to Milan, which is much more of a big city, the capitalist, much more of a pursuit of wealth and capitalist city, that ultimately destroys people, because, you know, then they get into this boxing career, and, you know, the ups and downs with that. There's a lot of prejudice towards them. You know, for anyone who doesn't know, there's deep divides between the south and north of Italy. And mm-hmm. often the south is what, you know, you see in the film, there are people in the north call them Hicks. I mean, they even called them, one of the characters says Afrikan, actually in the translation. Yeah. You have to really listen to it, because the translation says Hicks, but they were calling them, you know, like black people and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And so there's all the, even within their own country, which is so interesting, that they would go to the north and basically feel isolated, feel left out. And I thought of my own family, because I know they came from Italy to Canada. And up until the 70s, at least in Canada, there was still a lot of prejudice against mm-hmm. Italian people because of the war and things, you know, and because of Mussolini and the fascists and things like that. And I even see now in my own parents, even though my mother was only 5 when she came here, there is still this feeling of that she doesn't really feel like she belongs here. That she, you know, and so that need to always fit in, that need to, that pressure to, you know, integrate with society and shed your, you know, shed your Italian roots. I found that really, really fascinating. And the film, you know, shows that in a different way, but, that's one way of looking at it, is that this, you know, I think politically speaking, he's saying, you know, it's almost like a communist perspective. It's like, you know, if we live in a place of purity, we won't become corrupt by these capitalistic systems. So I think that's a valid interpretation and a way of looking at it. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, I think Visconti is probably not making it that simple. I think he's posing more questions, because naturally, when they go to Milan, obviously they do have certain advantages economically mm-hmm. speaking. They're all like working, they're making more money. And they compared what they were going to in the South, like slavery, and things like that. And so I don't think he's necessarily making it
it's not black and white. Yeah.
It's not black and white, you know, and there's other political things we can get into, but ultimately what's this Simone destroying himself, we see how Rocco is being, and I can really relate to this. I've seen it in my own family, is that keeping the family together is so important to that culture. Mm-hmm. And we see how Rocco will do anything to keep the family unit together. And even though his brother, Chito, is saying, oh, you know, he's a terrible person, and he compares him to, you know, weeds that you have to pull. And Rocco, he cannot have the family unit break apart. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and of course he brings it to these operatic places, you know, even though Alain Delon falls in love with his ex-girlfriend who was a prostitute, you know, who could accept that your brother raped this woman and you still want to help him, and that you still mm-hmm. and raped him in front of her, front of him. And they got into this fist fight. He destroys them. I mean, that scene is so devastating to watch. Yeah. It has that operatic quality. And of course the Nino Rota score is so powerful, and just these emotions hit you in such a visceral way. And even though he elevates it that way with this really heightened way of looking at it, I think at its core, it's about the threat of the family and how the struggle Rocco has is to keep the family together no matter what. And so, you know, all these gambling debts he gets into, he tries to pay it off. He tells Simone's ex-girlfriend to go back with him even after the rape. It's sort of Nadia, that's her name. Mm-hmm. It's really ugly and it's appalling, but at its core, that's what it's about. You know, let's keep things together and let's not destroy one another, no matter what. And Rocco, you know, when you keep trying to do the same thing over and over again, and you're expecting a different result,
there's
something insane about that. And I don't think Rocco learns until the very end that he has to, you know, once he's killed this woman, that's it, that it's over. At least within the family unit, there, you know, one of them is now gonna have to be removed, and what that means, you know. So there's so much to unpack. I can go on and on, but I'd love to hear some of your thoughts as well.
No, I agree with you. I think actually what you were pointing out, that the actress you had on was also indicating, is there is this political reading that you can get from this movie, but also all of his movies, The Leopard as well. The End of the Leopard, kind of this idea of a changing Italy, where you don't want to fall prey to corruption, or people who maybe get by in society, or those who are a little bit more morally pliable or able to kind of roll with things. Kind of the old guard is dying out. Not that he's saying in a simple way. I mean, even Death in Venice, to some extent, there's all these debates about beauty, and, you know, there are these artistic debates going on, kind of when money corrupts or when commerce or society, and it kind of goes throughout all of his films. And I think he is sort of raising questions of maybe the South wasn't perfect, but it represents a certain thing to these people. But then there are advantages of, well, you know, if you can't pay your rent, then the government will provide. But then also you want to try to get ahead when brother is starting to go to night school and work in factories. And so kind of like, how do you adapt and make yourself better, but also be a part of society and responsible? So I think he's saying there are polar ends. There's a lot going on with that. I am with you. I am someone who I am completely susceptible to any movie about siblings, especially. Last night I watched, not even thinking that it was going to destroy me, but of course it destroyed me. The Iron Claw just made its way to digital.
Oh, right.
I've not seen it. And boy, that one, yeah, that's going to stay with me for a while. You Can Count on Me is another film. Anything about siblings is going to hit hard. And so I remember this movie doing that. And I also remember being a younger woman and, you know, in my like late teens, early 20s, and some of the, you know, the idea of the rape, and, you know, it was hard to wrap my head around it as a young woman and not really get like the time and the religion and society and all of that. And
right.
So I think,
right.
you know, the more you learn about history and what was going on between men and women and religion in this country, then you're able to view it in a different light. And I also think, you know, like any of these movies, I loved what you were saying about revisiting some of them years later, because, you know, you get older and you might relate a little more to one of the brothers than another. You might identify more with the one going to night school and then Rocco, and then, you know,
yes,
go back
yes.
and forth. And I think that's important. Yeah, I think it's a really fascinating film. This is one that is so complicated. There are so many characters. It's like,
oh, yeah,
hours. But this one, you really, out of all of them, I think, well, it is, I think, his best. But it's also the one that will reward you the most, I think, on repeat viewings. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I completely agree. And it's so, you know, I went back and I watched the film again the other night, but I went just to look at the last scene. And it's so interesting because Cheeto is talking to his younger brother about how, you know, Simone destroyed himself, but that he actually learned more from Simone about the fact that in the South they were like, you know, obedient slaves. But you have to ask yourself, why did Visconti have all of those workers walk into the factory behind him, and they're all in, you know, it's the matching uniforms.
Yep.
They're working for Alfa Romeo. Only people very wealthy could buy those cars.
Exactly.
And so, and is that, and so I think the question is that not sort of an obedient worker? Even though he's probably making more money, in principles, that's the same thing. Right. So it's so fascinating to me. And I, you know, there's good things about capitalism. There's good things about socialism.
Sure.
You know, there's always, and people have extreme views. And ultimately, I think the best solution often is the, you know, the middle ground, right? I would consider myself, a liberal. I would consider myself having, you know, more left-wing views, but, you know, I do question my own views. And
oh,
I think the film is sort of getting you to do that. But at the same time, this is a film about family, about human beings, and their struggle to keep the family unit together. And what's interesting about, and I had never thought this before, and I really don't see it in the film, but the filmmaker who I admire, Mark Rapaport, he felt that in this film that they only use Nadia as a way to code the fact that Simone and Rocco were actually in love with each other. And so they put, he felt that it was like, they put the woman in the middle, because you see how, even though she's been raped by Simone, Rocco still tries to save him. Even in the end, when he kills her, you see Rocco, which is a really emotional scene, he's like stroking his cheek and they're both crying on the bed. Mm-hmm. And so he thought, he didn't like it, because they thought, they just put this poor woman in the middle, and it was like misogynistic that she was used as a device. But I think as an Italian. Yeah, no, I don't see that either. And I could perhaps see that from someone who isn't Italian. This is not perhaps necessarily just an Italian thing. I'm sure other cultures are like this as well. But the family unit, keeping the family unit together is such a part of Italian culture, such a part of Southern culture. And even though, again, it's a very heightened operatic way of doing it. I mean, he was highly influenced by opera, Visconti. He directed a lot of opera. Oh, yeah. He loved theater. Mm-hmm. He directed a lot of plays. You see that influence in his work with these big, big emotions. And if people have a hard time accepting that, you have to, like, the essence of it is really about the fact that Rocco is keeping the family unit together no matter what. The one character who I think he is making a little more obviously gay is the boxing manager Simone, sure. Which, again, this is the beauty of this film. It's so detailed. I never picked up on until 2 years ago. My guest on that episode, she pointed it out.
She said,
yes, yeah, he's like watching them longingly in the shower.
Yeah.
He also gives Simone a chance, even though he says that Simone is a little older and he's like really invested in his career. When he sees Simone walk off with Nadia, he tries to get his attention with the lights on his car, and it doesn't work. And then later he brings him to his apartment, which is such a great scene. After, you know, this is when he's really going down a bad path, Simone, and he's very vulnerable, and he brings him to his apartment. He's giving him alcohol, and then he starts to beat him up, and he even says, "You exploited my weaknesses," right? Yeah. But then he beats him up, and then he slowly shuts off the TV, shuts off the light, and then it just goes to the next day. So it's really, and I never picked up on that. So and he even says to Simone, he says to him, "Oh, these prostitutes are just a front for you." So I guess maybe he thought Simone was gay. Maybe that was a wishful thinking. But the fact that he said, "You exploited my weaknesses," he's clearly not a man who felt that he could come out. And so he was maybe hated the fact that he was gay. And I think the fact that he's hitting him is because he's feeling like you're reminding me of who I am, or of who I am. Mm-hmm. And that is so, so interesting to me. And I never gave that character a lot of thought, to be honest. I don't know if that was your impression.
Oh, I saw it right away with that man. But as far as the brothers go, I think, that is an Italian thing. We're highly emotional, highly affectionate people. My grandma and her sisters, you know, they hug and kiss everybody and they're always touching each other. Yes. So I think, you know, it's an expressive thing. Also, like you were saying, the influence of opera, for sure. Also, I think there's some hero worship there. They have lost their father. And so it becomes Simone represents strength, I think, to Rocco a little bit. And so he might see him sort of almost as like a second
father. Oh, that's a good point.
I think that might be like, I can't lose another male figurehead, possibly is what's going on there too. But as far as the fight guy, for sure, I saw that he was definitely in love with Simone. Yes.
Which again is so fascinating how he managed to get all of this nuance and all these perspectives and feelings into this. I was actually watched another short documentary last night, and one of the people who worked on the film, after they screened it, he said to Visconti, this film is so beautiful. And as he was talking about it, you could see like it was as if he was watching it for the first time and he just started crying. And I thought, because it is so powerful. And that score by Nino Rota, of course, you know,
in the cinematography
and you know, Nino Rota, of course, did the Godfather score. I mean, to me, without Visconti, there is no Scorsese, there's no Coppola. Maybe not no Scorsese or no Coppola.
Yeah, but no Raging Bull or Godfather in the way that they are. Yeah,
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can even look at Mean Streets with the character of Charlie. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a little different because Charlie is protecting Johnny at all costs for his own selfish, guilty reasons because he mm-hmm. feels that he's committing sins and he's very Catholic. So it's not so much out of like love of family. It's more he's doing it. I mean, he has love for Johnny, but he's doing it for himself. So, but it has that in common. And I mean, I could talk endlessly about it, but I just absolutely adore this film.
Yeah. Yeah. What we're saying is revisit it for sure. It's a masterpiece for a reason, yeah. But we should probably move on to The Leopard.
For sure.
Which, you know, I did an episode on Burt Lancaster. It was actually our 200th episode with Adam Neiman, who I know.
Adam. Yes.
He's been on my show. On your show as well. He's wonderful. And he was referencing him working with Visconti, I believe, twice, right? Lancaster?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. This and in another really, really good movie called Conversation Piece, which was one of his last films.
Yes. And I know originally he didn't really want Lancaster. Like he got on this film and, you know, and Lancaster can be kind of a difficult person to work with, but they got along. They respected each other and he knew that this was going to be a work of art. And boy, is it ever. It's one of the most beautiful films ever made, I believe.
Yeah.
There is a dance sequence in this thing that goes on for like 45 minutes. It kind of spans it, sort of the thesis of the film. Like you can just say this entire sequence says so much about what the movie and what I think Visconti wants to say. But I'd love to know your relationship with The Leopard. So tell me about it.
Well, it's interesting that you brought up that note of trivia. And yeah, in order, he got money from 20th Century Fox,
yes.
who,
mm-hmm.
yeah, so it was a co-production, Italian-American co-production. He needed more money, and so the stipulation was, well, you have to use an American star. And initially, Lancaster was on a short list, but then they said they made him use him. And he did not, Visconti did not want to use him at all. He just thought he said he was just some cowboy actor. But he once he saw him in Judgment at Nuremberg, he agreed, even though, again, he wasn't thrilled with it. And yeah, apparently he was very hostile towards Lancaster at first. He was treating him badly, and Lancaster's not a guy who's going to take that, you know. And apparently on the set, he screamed at Visconti, and Visconti is not the kind of guy you scream at. You know, he was an intimidating presence, you know. That documentary you watched, that BBC one. I mean, people who worked with him, you know, say
even his lover, love hate.
Yes.
They were saying, they were screaming matches. Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he could sort of had a violent temper at times on set and stuff like that. But once he stood up to him, that's when Visconti was like, okay, yeah, he's good for this part.
Yeah.
I kind of love that he wasn't offended. It was more that he saw something in his temperament that then convinced him that he can do it. But like I said, I didn't really care for it at first. And it's a little challenging because he doesn't give you all of the historical context about what was going on.
You have to do some of your own research. I did when I was revisiting.
I did too.
Yeah, I'm like, wait a minute, what was going on in Italy? Yes, yes.
Yeah, because I watched it last week for the first time in 3.5 years or something. So I couldn't remember everything. I remember, you know, it's about the unification of Italy.
Yes.
But yeah, so you have to kind of always go back. So he doesn't give you all that context. So it could be a little difficult. There's a lot of exposition, again, a lot of characters. But what really is the essence of it is this man who is really seeing a changed world that he no longer fits into. And he's looking at death coming, and he is basically mourning the fact that the way he lived on top, as in this ruling class, is over. And you know, if I met an aristocrat who was very, very rich on the street and told me that he's so sad that he's no longer on the top of the world, I would say, buddy, give me a break. But yeah, if he's
the world's smallest violin. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. But Visconti, and this is also just a testament to the Lancaster's brilliant performance, he really makes you feel for him. And I think it's because, again, the heart of it is that
it's Italy.
It's Italy, and it's a guy, and I think any of us, even young people, we have things in our past that are no longer there.
Yeah.
Whether it's friends, or maybe we lived in a different city or in a different country, and that's gone, and life is never the same. And so particularly as you get to be older and older, that gets harder and harder. And I think that's really the glue in this film. So that's the beauty of this, is that he can explore people experiencing poverty, and that he can explore like this prince, this rich aristocrat who was part of this ruling class. And you can identify with him. You can feel for him. But he's also extremely flawed. I mean, you see him, he cheats on his wife.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't speak highly of his children when they're trying to talk to him. He's ignoring them. He's more interested in his nephew by the Delon character, because
yeah,
he admires the fact that Delon is ambitious, that he knows how to Falconeri. I'm just looking at Delon's character, Tancredi. Falconeri. He admires that, you know, he's someone who could succeed in a changing Italy. You know, he's this opportunist, and he was part of the red shirts and the revolution, and then he changes allegiances. And you see the prince says, "Hey, I thought you guys were wearing red shirts," and he's like, "No, I'm with the others."
I know.
He changed. Yeah. And so, you know, he's someone that you would imagine would have, you know, during World War II would have just easily went with the fascists, because no matter what, it's about staying on top. And as he says to the prince, because the prince is worried about what's going on in Italy, and he says, you know, for everything to stay the same, everything has to change. And so, in other words, what that becomes to mean is that things are going to change. It's inevitable it's going to change, but we have to find ways to stay on top. And that's all these guys care about, which is sad that's, you know, forget about other people. It's about them, right? It's about what they can get out of it. So he's certainly a deeply flawed character. And even later when he sees his nephew marry Angelica Sadara, who Claudia Cardinale plays, his wife is so upset because she's the daughter of a mafioso.
Yeah.
And the prince is like, who cares? You know, he's like, he needs the money. You know, his father spent all his money, and it's a changing world, and he's doing what he has to do. And again, it's like, these guys are fucking warped. I mean, the fact that they are so obsessed. That's why when I watched the review and I heard someone say it's pro-aristocrat, I'm like, how is it pro-aristocrat? He is clearly showing these deep flaws and this obsession with power and money and greed at all costs. He can still make you feel for a guy who is ultimately, you know, not doesn't exactly have very good principles. And but, you know, that last hour or so is remarkable, because like we touched on with Death of Venice, which we're going to get into, so much is happening without any dialogue. You know, he's at this dance, this ballroom, there's all these young people dancing. And Visconti was very interested in history when things changed, and how that affected people. And, you know, you see him in the ballroom, he's often alone. People are not really interested in talking to him. That classic shot of him looking in the mirror with the tear going down his cheek. And, you know, looking at the painting where those people are mourning the death of someone, and it's reminding him of what's ahead of him. It's so powerful. I mean, it is absolutely remarkable how he takes this flawed man who is this greedy, you know, aristocratic, apathetic person, and ultimately makes you identify with him. You know, I think you can also see that later in Scorsese's movies, taking like the worst kind of people, but yet you can't help but feel for some of these people. It's stunning. I mean, it's a stunning, stunning film. So curious your thoughts as well.
I think it is a man coming to terms with his own mortality and kind of mourning something in the past. But I also don't know that he's he is 100% on board at all with the mafiosi guy. He understands Tancredi's like, okay, he needs to marry this woman for money. But he also totally gets like that, okay, my nephew is going to be able to adapt in this new Italy where you have to change allegiance and nothing stays anymore. And I do feel like he knows that's wrong. He's willing to kind of go with it, but it's like things are moving too quickly for him. Life is passing him by and Italy is changing. And so I think it's a complicated interpretation at the end. I haven't read the book. I'm fascinated by it. I know Lancaster said, quote, "I think it is the best written and most perceptive study of a man and his background that has appeared for many years," is what he said about the novel. So he was quite a fan of the book. I think it's also interesting in the documentary I watched, I want to say it might have been the cinematographer, I hope I'm not pronouncing that incorrect, is it Rotano? Giuseppe.
But I know, because the book was also by an aristocrat who was a he was a conservative aristocrat.
Yes.
Which is so, interesting. Different. And then a communist aristocrat is the director. So that was Lampedusa. Yeah.
Wrote the book. And then the cinematographer was, I want to say, was it Giuseppe Ritano? I think so.
Yeah. I'm trying to find that on IMDb.
In the documentary, he was talking about how the leopard represents, like, okay, that was the old guard, and then the future is just hyenas and jackals, and that is what Italy becomes, which I loved. Yes.
Yeah, which is what, you know, he says that, right? It's like, we were the leopards, we were the we were the ones on top, and now it's taken over by hyenas. Yeah, because you're right, he doesn't like any of these things.
No.
But he's willing to go for it because he sees that there's going to be advantages. And again, that's such a universal, you know, tactic. Because I think a lot of times people do things that they don't really like, but they do it anyways because there's going to be some kind of advantage for them. Mm-hmm. You see that certainly in politics.
We're seeing that now. Yeah.
Yeah. You just see that in people's, you know, day-to-day choices. And you know, like I had said earlier with Rocco and his brothers, I really see a lot of my family in that. And, you know, when they came from the south of Italy to Canada, because they were impressionable and innocent and uneducated, you know, whatever people told them was what they needed to do is what they felt had to be done. And so there is a sort of corruption there of the spirit. And, you know, it's like, okay, well, appearances are big deals. Money's a big deal. Jobs are a big deal. And so you're just doing things that, you know, maybe some things are good about them, but you're doing things that probably go against your own principles.
Yeah.
And you see that with the prince. I mean, you know, his wife is appalled that he's going to marry this woman who's the daughter of a mafioso. Again, he doesn't like it, but at the same time, he gets it. Right. And so there's something complex and compromising about that, which again, fascinates me.
Yeah. And I think in this one, you have a very good performance, too. She doesn't get much to work with. Unfortunately, the female characters really don't. But Claudia Cardinale is great in the documentary. She was talking about how Visconti directed her to just laugh and laugh and laugh and create like the biggest scandal ever. And she said she got so into it, she couldn't stop laughing. And everyone was just looking at her. And she had memories of doing that scene at the dinner table, and it just, you know, causes such a ruckus. And that whole sequence is pretty shocking. And I like to, in the reactions of everyone, you see people's values and who's willing to go along with things, which I think, talking about a communist who made his way through World War II and those experiences we were talking about, he's going to have maybe some ideas on, like we said, about some political allegory going on through this movie. But, you know, I mean, the thing about history is everyone thinks they're inventing something or their generation is the first to experience some of these things. But we should pay attention to history because it keeps repeating, and it just repeated again in the life of Visconti before he made this movie. Yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You're absolutely right. And you know, Claudia Cardinale, who's also in Rocco and His Brothers, small part.
Yes.
And you're right. The films we're talking about today are mainly male-driven.
Yeah.
But he did make a number of films where the women were more at the forefront. The other one that he did with Cardinale, where she was the lead, is Vague Stars of Ursa, which has a few different titles. It's also called Sandra. You know, of course, his Romy Schneider with Ludwig and Boccaccio 70. She's the lead. But yeah, there's, you know, there are some more female driven films, but just not in the ones we're doing.
I haven't seen those, actually.
Well-known.
Yeah.
Yeah, the ones that people discuss more are more of his, you know, heavy male ones. But yeah, Boccaccio 60 is great. And The Innocent that I just saw, and Sandra's quite good. So, you know, if anyone's interested, just go through his filmography and check them out.
Yeah. Well, you also just mentioned... was it Ludwig you mentioned recently?
Ludwig, yeah. I haven't seen Ludwig yet.
I haven't either. And I was going to say this is from his period. You also talked about The Damned and Death in Venice. So we have three. This was like the German trilogy. I'm going to let you introduce these. Or talk about, Death of Venice.
Yeah, well, you know, this to me is like it's perfect film or a near perfect film. And also, you know, this Thomas Mann adapted, but from this Thomas Mann novel, and again is so complicated. And he even tells you less about this person than he does about the prince. And so, you know, long stretches of no dialogue.
Yeah.
And you really have to, and people have all kinds of interpretations. Mine might be different than others, but it's ultimately, you know, where he talked about like Rocco and His Brothers, he couldn't, you know, the homosexuality wasn't as explicit,
yes.
But mm-hmm. here it's much more so, you know, because he's going to Venice. He's this composer from Germany, and he, you know, obviously something is deeply wrong, and we get this information in flashbacks. And he often only really suggests things, you know, and so we have to kind of make up our own mind. And, you know, what a lot of people feel and think was that when he went to Venice, he fell in love with this young boy who's like the image of perfect beauty. And mm-hmm. I reviewed it last year, actually, with our mutual friend, Raquel Stetcher. And some people left comments saying that they didn't even feel he was in love with the boy. Some people feel that he wanted to be the father to the boy because of the fact that his child died. And
but I don't see that. No.
Yeah. I don't quite see that, but I can see how people would maybe think that, because when he is looking at Tazio, the young boy early on in the film, in the big dining room there, when Tazio's mother comes, Silvana Mangano, he also looks a long time at her. So some people think, oh, well, maybe he wants to be a part of the family. You see later on, there's this plague there in Venice, and he warns them. So it has like a father, a protective quality. But I would say it leans much more towards this attraction towards him. And I think, you know, what we can say that's in common in all these films, all these characters are trapped in the past.
That's what I kind of saw too. Like life is passing him by, and he represents this unattainable beauty of like youth. You know, when you're 20, you think you're going to look like that forever, or you're going to have all these, you know, lovers, and all of these experiences are never going to end. And I think he's maybe also seeing this boy who has his whole future ahead of him a little bit. So I think there's a combination. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the whole thing feels like it's like purgatory. You know, it's like he's on this boat. It's almost like this big
slow
coffin.
Moving. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, he's this guy who, you know, you see these arguments with one of his students, who he's, and they're arguing about art, and you know, he feels that art is something you have to control, and that the beauty comes from control. And his, you know, his pupil thinks, no, it's, you know, it's spontaneity. It's, you know, people interpret it in different ways. And so it's these arguments about what is art. And I think because the Dirk Bogarde feels so strongly about control, that also is how he lives his life. And clearly, or at least the way I look at it, was that he was either bisexual or gay. Mm-hmm. And he had to hide that, right? He had to control it, and it, yes. and he couldn't let it out. And so, you know, he was married with this child, but was that ultimately a cover, because he couldn't come out? And so all of these conversations are about this man who needs to control every single aspect of his life so people don't see who he is. And as now he's in Venice, and he's losing more of that control, because this image of perfect beauty with this boy is making him feel all sorts of visceral things. And you do see, like, and again, he doesn't tell you with dialogue exactly how to feel or what to think. You know, sometimes he sees the young boy, and then he runs into his hotel room, and he's like perspiring, and mm-hmm. he's like, you know, well, how has my life gotten here? And it's like, well, what does he mean by that? And so you have to kind of come up with your own interpretation. But I think those feelings of him getting emotional and getting stressed out, and at one point he tries to leave because of these feelings he's having, but then his luggage gets lost and sent to Como, and then he's excited that he has to go back.
Yeah.
You know, and it's clearly because he's like, oh, I get to see the young boy again, right? So it's all these complex, contradictory feelings, and I think ultimately it's really about this person who's, again, like the prince, facing death. And it's one last chance to come to terms with his homosexuality and his art, and his regrets and things that he maybe did wrong, until, of course, you know, the end is, you know, it's like you see the, you know, the young boy points upwards, and as he's in the water, and it's almost like the angel of death, you know, and then he dies, and all that makeup he had on is melting.
Yes.
Off his face. And you wonder about that too, because he goes to the barber and the guy makes him look like a corpse. You know, he puts all this
just
black,
just like the beginning
of
the film when he meets somebody like that, who accosts him when he first gets there. And it's garish, and it's like almost like Kabuki theater. Like, it's very white, and there's dye running down his face, and there's all kinds of stuff happening, and he's like melting away in the sun. So I think it kind of reminded me of not a very good film, but one that came out a couple of years ago, is Sundown with Tim Roth, kind of. Some of the similar, like, maybe they saw this and were like, oh, I want to
do that a little bit.
It wasn't the greatest, but I think it had some ideas that were clever. But I liked what you were saying too about the slow moving boat, because it is like he's taking a coffin. It's very symbolic. And the thing of the question of control, everyone says that about, of course, Visconti, but also filmmakers in general, you know, like Vertigo is about control, and these are confessional films made by directors. And I think this is such a marriage of subject and the person making it. It's super autobiographical. And then there's the element of Dirk Bogarde being in the film, and his background as a gay man, and what that was like. And so I think there's a lot of intertextuality that you can read into this movie. So it is one that I think, it's one of those films, like, if you're a film school professor, it's probably, well, you'd have to make sure the kids put down the phone and, like, pay attention. But then everyone would have a different interpretation, I think, of everything in this movie. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Because even that man at the boat, who also has similar makeup, and he says, oh, he he says something along the lines of like, oh, you know, I wish your sweetheart well. And it's like, well,
it's so weird. Yeah.
It's almost as if these are like angels and they know what's going to come, you know, it's like, they know that he's going to meet the young boy and what the young boy is going to bring out of him. And even that musician who he has a similar look, that guitar player.
It's so strange.
And he's asking him about the plague. And everyone keeps telling him that it's, oh, you know, don't worry about it. They're going to disinfect Venice. And one thing I picked up on in my last viewing was, I think that is also a metaphor for the fact, because, like, you know, when you're sick, you lose a sense of control, right? You can't do all the things. And his pupil actually says to him, you should get the plague at one point when they're arguing. And I think what he meant by that is, you know, when you're sick, things are going to happen that you can't control. Right. And I think that's what that represents, right. Is the sickness, that is also changing things about him and how he's facing death
and too. Also, like you said,
Yeah, exactly. And again, even though he begins to sort of step into who he is more, like you do see him when he comes back to the hotel and he's waving at the young boy in the window. He's happy to see him on the beach at times. But he does get somewhere. But then there's the part of, oh, but what about the fact that I'm aging? And I think all that makeup is sort of representing the fact that, you know, if you keep trying to be young and hang on to your youth, you're going to look like you can't, you know, you look like you're going to look like this corpse.
Yeah.
So again, it's like, it's not just like, oh, he got somewhere. Then at least he stepped into something that he didn't see before. It's like, no, there's also this element of aging and death that he doesn't really want to face. And ultimately he dies, at least my interpretation is he dies at least having stepped into himself more than he had in when he was younger. But it's really a tragic film.
Yes.
But again, a film that the first viewing will be very difficult. You have to really watch it with your eyes wide open. And I would, again, like I said, with all these films, you know, watch it again, like, the next week, because I think in the first viewing you'll maybe make some decisions for yourself, and then when you go to it again you'll be able to just really enjoy it and really feel for it. But you have to wrestle with it. It's not simple at all.
No, and again, just like The Leopard, we're talking about an exquisitely beautiful film. Gorgeous score. You're dealing with like Mahler's fifth and Mahler's second that play throughout. And yeah, and I think also if you're a fan of Barry Lyndon, you should know it shares an actress, Marissa Berenson. Is that the actress's name, I believe, who is in this small role?
Was she the wife or the prostitute?
Yeah.
Okay, that was, because I thought, because the prostitute looked similar when he goes to the bordello at one point. Oh, yeah,
which
you're
was
right.
Was interesting, Barry, yes. Yeah,
I love that scene too, because one thing I noticed when I reviewed it last year was that when he goes into the dining area and he sees Tazio there, Tazio's playing the piano.
Yes.
And when they cut to that flashback, the prostitute's playing the same song on the piano.
Yes.
So it's almost like Tazio, perhaps the angel of death, is putting these memories into him to say, it's like, confront yourself. And it's interesting because he goes to that prostitute. He looks like he's about to have sex with her, and then he leaves, you know? So why was he there? Was that before he was married? Was that after he was married? Was he trying to see whether he was gay or not, to sleep with a woman? You don't know, right? You get a suggestion, right? And that's how flashbacks and memories work, right? They come in pieces.
Yeah, like dreams, you know, they don't all make sense. Yes.
Exactly. And he's got that. And I never even realized that at the end that was a dream. You know, you see him, he's at the symphony and everyone's booing him. Mm-hmm. And I just realized, oh, I never realized that that's actually a dream.
Yeah.
Because I thought, well, why would you get booed? I always thought that was strange. Like, why would you get booed at a symphony, but I think it's the fear of if I step into all who I am, people will hate me, you know, and if I let go of
this control. Yeah,
exactly. And that, and you know, his student is like happy that he did it backstage, but he's like in distress and he's like, send the press away. And then you see him waking in the night screaming. And again, I never put that together as a dream. I thought that was just the next scene. But I think it's a dream. I don't know if you thought, I think that's a dream. I don't know what you thought.
I think it might be. It's hard. Yeah. Like another, you're going to have to watch these, I think, multiple times, and you're going to get a different read each time. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I know you mentioned a couple other ones as we were talking. Are there any you want to be sure to say, like, these are my next tier favorites or movies that people should seek out before I let you go?
Well, I mean, certainly Ossessione, which is his first film. I thought The Innocent, which is his last film, was remarkable. I must admit, I actually have not seen La Terra Trema, okay, which I'm ashamed to say.
Oh, but I haven't seen it in forever, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to definitely see it sometime this year. But yeah, Conversation Piece, The Damned is incredible. I know we had thought to also do that today, but I think you were right. That would just be too much with these three.
Yeah, it's not streaming, and it's
yeah, you could get the Criterion put it out on Blu-ray, which I have to get. But I mean, I recommend all of them. Senso, La Notte Bianchi, you know, Boccaccio 60 is actually four different directors, so it's like four short films into one film. That is incredible. I haven't seen Bellissima, even though that's very close to my last name,
but yeah.
I haven't seen that. The Stranger I just saw last year, that one you can't find anywhere, and I normally would not recommend like people checking out a bootleg, but it's literally the only way to see it. It was never restored. It's never been put out on DVD or Blu-ray or anywhere. I don't know why. It's also with Mastroianni, who was in The White Knights, La Nota Bianchi, and that's really good. I mean, I really recommend all of them. I mean, there's not one bad film. I think the only one that I wasn't crazy about was Vague Stars of Ursa, which is also called Sandra, but I have to go back to it again because it's kind of like The Leopard. There's a lot of exposition and I only saw it once.
Okay.
So the first viewing, I think I maybe would find it more rewarding a second time. But I mean, the genius of a filmmaker like this is because you have to grapple with everything so much. And, you know, for people who maybe don't understand why that may be of value. And for me, it's like the more you can grapple with a great work of art, the more you can grapple with life, you know, the more you can grapple with the mysteries of life, you know, when people do things and, you know, some people are easily dismissive or just are black and white about things, you know, try to, you know, you, when you take things from people's point of view, you can understand them more. And so he's a guy who does not feed you all the answers, Visconti. And so you look at these films, I think you'll see your own families. I think you'll see people, you know, even though we're talking about aristocrats and peasants in the south of Italy. And it's universal themes, all of them. And, you know, he's a humanist filmmaker to me and one of the greats. So yeah, this has been a great chat, certainly.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. And I will be on Robert's show in a couple months talking about The Player, Robert Altman's film. But Robert, I want to thank you so much for doing this. It's such a pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. And anytime to talk about Visconti or any of the Italian masters, I'm certainly there. So thanks so much for the opportunity.
Of course. I also want to thank everyone for listening, especially my patrons who support the show and help fund my research, equipment, film rentals, RSS fees, and more for as little as $1 per month at the Film Intuition Patreon, which is the home base for the show. Other ways you can support the podcast are by sharing, reviewing, and subscribing to Watch with Jen wherever you get your podcasts, and also checking out the cool merch store hosted and created by our talented logo designer, Kate Gabrielle. You can find the merchandise store, including shirts, tote bags, stickers, and more, by visiting filmintuition.com and clicking on the shop link. The show's theme music is Solo Acoustic Guitar by Jason Shaw and is available in the free music archive. You can also reach me or interact with Watch with Jen anytime on Twitter, either at Film Intuition or our Watch with Jen account as well. Well, until next time, please take care and happy movie watching. This is Jen Johans at filmintuition.com and Film Intuition on social media and Letterboxd. And this is Watch with Jen.